This podcast is intended for investment professionals. The COVID-19 pandemic has caused widespread volatility across global financial markets, not least in the UK property market, which has experienced significant uncertainty these past few months. Most noticeably, the retail and office sectors have been badly hit by lockdowns across the country. However, despite these challenging times, the build-to-rent sector has remained resilient, with occupancy rates and rent collection remaining robust. So, how has the build-to-rent sector weathered the storm, and can it future-proof itself for the new normal world? To discuss this, I'm joined by Dan Batterton, Head of Build-to-Rent at Elgin Real Assets, and Michael Adefuye, Research Manager at Elgin Real Assets. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks, Jean. Yeah, nice to speak to you. Nice to be on the podcast.
To kick things off, Michael, for those that may not know, what is build-to-rent and what is the sector like?
Well, it sticks pretty close to what it says on the tin, really. Fundamentally, build-to-rent or BTR is new build residential development which have been purpose-built specifically for rent as opposed to home ownership. Unlike, say, the traditional private rental sector, which is usually dominated by individual buy-to-let landlord, these developments will be institutionally owned at quite a large scale and professionally managed by specialist operators. They usually come with a host of different characteristics, which you would normally see in traditional PRS sectors, such as longer term tenancies, integrated on-site management, high-speed broadband in every home, and communal amenities like gyms, co-working spaces, and cinema rooms in some of the more luxury apartments.
Fantastic. So Dan, it would be great to hear more about Elgin's place in the build-to-rent sector. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Our start of the journey really was, well, probably 5 or 6 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago now even, when we were set the simple quiz question of, as the biggest or one of the biggest investors into the UK, why are we not really invested into the biggest asset class into the UK? Residential being that biggest asset class. And yet, as an institution, it wasn't something we were really that active in, certainly not in a invest and hold. And so we spent a couple of years really looking at the residential market around the world. And it is an institutionally recognized, mature, professionally managed asset class in many, many economies around the world, mainland Europe, the US. It is absolutely normal for pension funds to invest into the residential sector. And yet in the UK, that has never been the case, or I thought had never been the case. And then I found out that 100 years ago, the houses across London and across the UK were being built by the pension funds. They were being built by Legal & General, which was a bit of a surprise, as we're now trying to build these homes and hold them as investments. And actually, we built them 100 years ago and sold them off. And so it's sort of trying to create an asset class in the UK that is of institutional quality. That means that we are happy to put our reputation behind the homes we build. And then for the residents that are living there, they are proud of where they live. They recognize that their landlord is an institution. We're not trying to build homes, make a bit of capital growth and sell them on. People can create lifestyles where they live. They can be proud of the locations they live in and settle down and make roots, because we offer really long leases, because our business model means we want long-term cash flow. We value somebody staying for a long time in our homes. So actually, this business model creates different incentives for a landlord renting out property than perhaps a traditional landlord in the private rented sector that we would expect.
Great. So looking at Elgin's position as an investment manager, what is the investment rationale for the build-to-rent sector?
Well, I guess it comes down to structural fundamentals of the sector. So when we think about demand and supply, in the UK, we believe that there's an inherent imbalance between housing demand and housing supply at the moment. Now, estimates suggest that we need somewhere around 300,000 homes a year to 320,000 homes a year to meet the housing need of the country as the population grows. But on average, over the last 10 years, we've only been building around 200,000 homes a year. So there's this growing imbalance between what we need and what's actually available. So we see that creating a strong foundation for the fundamental of the sector. For investors, the sector itself offers strong, stable income stream, which historically we've seen to have actually been well correlated with inflation. And it's typically matched inflation over the long term, and in some instances grown faster than inflation. So you get that stable income long term. And that stability is what we consider to be quite key in the investment rationale. So we know housing is very much a needs-based asset class. Everyone needs a place to live in one sense. And what we've seen is that during periods of economic crisis, whether it's a recession or just general economic uncertainty, we generally see that residential assets remain quite robust and the income they generate remains quite stable through that period. So we see that as being the fundamental investment rationale.
So talking about strong and stable income stream, which is primarily down to rental payments in the sector, it'll be interesting to hear a bit more about what the typical tenant is like. You know, I think when people think of build to rent, I mean, I'm thinking of a young professional who is looking to rent for a few years before buying. You know, am I right? Is there a typical occupier? Who is it?
Yeah, is there a typical occupier? There's an average occupier, but not a typical occupier. So that's one for Mike there for the researchers to try and follow. Let me explain. So when we started out, we were told by the experts that we should expect young professionals to be our tenants. The people that rent in the UK are young professionals. They're out of university. The Henrys, they're highly educated, but not rich yet. So the Henrys that will move on to home ownership at some point, but currently are renting. And I think we were all a bit skeptical about that, to assume the only people that rent in the UK are straight out of uni. Feels wrong, is wrong when you look at other data. So what have we got now? So across our 1,000 or so apartments that we have let, we do have an average age of 31. So that would imply a sort of a 25 to 35 year old average age. However, we have people, I think our oldest resident is 79, and we have newborn children. So everything between zero. In fact, some of the newborns were born in our apartments. So let's go from minutes old to 79 years old is the age range. And we don't really see a lot of sharers of the young professional sharers sharing locations. We see people living by themselves and in couples. And I think what's really surprised us is just how broad that demographic is, that the only thing really that is consistent amongst our occupiers is they want to live in that location within that city. Beyond that, the rationale for people to want to live in those locations is very broad, from distance to work, to distance to nightlife, to living near their friends, to living away from family, near university, to having left university and staying in similar locations. The only consistency is they want to live in that city. And so what we've learned, I suppose, is we need to create buildings that are a demographic, that we're not targeting a specific demographic or age group or occupier beyond targeting somebody that wants to live in that location.
One thing I will add to what Dan just mentioned there around the demographic as well is, it's just that concept of, in the UK, we did very much believe in the past that renting was this sort of temporary thing you did just after you finish university before you move on to your home ownership. And that's been the case in the early 90s when, you know, the proportion of people who rented was around 9%. But since then, it's been growing quite steadily and we're now close to a quarter of the population renting. And when you've got that kind of large demographic renting, that proportion, you are going to get this range of age groups. And we need to move away from that thinking of renting as just a temporary fix before, you know, you get your two up, two down house that everyone seems to want in the past.
Absolutely. Well, that's been an education for me. So how do you make sure you accommodate all the various needs of the diverse tenant base you have and also stand out from the crowd?
We spend a lot of time thinking about the design. So either you can consider it a blessing or a curse, but there aren't really purpose-built schemes in the UK for rent that you can just go out and buy. So in the same way we could go out and buy offices and industrial estates, we can't really just go out and buy up and build an income producing residential schemes, because the build quality won't be good enough, the location probably isn't in the right place, and the facilities and amenities available both for the team to run that scheme, like management suites and letting suites, and then facilities for the residents won't be up to standard. So we have to build everything that we're owning. And so that allows us to be much more creative, I suppose, in what we include in our schemes, trying to identify how we can, I think of us as selling more of a lifestyle than just the square feet of an apartment. That if you think generally we have a society that's moving away from ownership to access. So we're moving away from owning our music to having access to music, to owning video games to having access to video games. If you think of residential in the same way, it's having access to a lifestyle. And so how can we create a lifestyle in the buildings that we're building that is attractive and is aspirational and is something that people are going to be proud of? One of the lessons we learned very early on is to be able to do this, we have to build at scale. So the average scheme we're building is 350 apartments. That is over £100 million investment per scheme. It is very difficult for individual pension funds to have exposure to single assets of that size, because that is putting a lot of concentration risk into a single asset. So we're seeing from pension funds an interest in pooling their equity to get diversified exposure to very large lot sizes. But that scale allows us to include lifestyle aspects into the buildings. So within our buildings, all of them have a gym, all of them have space to allow people to work from home, and maybe we'll come back to that in terms of COVID impact, but they've all got a space for people to work from home. And in some of them, we've got a swimming pool, we've got private dining rooms. It ranges really based on what we think the local market in that local area wants. But it's about establishing a lifestyle, including all of those that value within the rent. So people don't pay extra to access the gym. That's a cost saving in the rest of their life. They don't need a gym membership. But providing all of that saving within rent to try and give them a different lifestyle that they otherwise couldn't afford if they were buying these elements one at a time.
So let's move on to the case for build to rent as a sector. We've seen that it managed to stay resilient during the global financial crisis, but we're now in a new crisis, COVID-19 pandemic. So how has the build to rent sector fared during the early stages of this crisis, and how is it faring today?
Well, it's been quite a reassuringly positive story for the asset class, really. Like you mentioned, you know, theoretically from a research perspective, we've always talked about, you know, build to rent sector being very resilient in crises. We've talked about the GFC, and it's just been reassuring to see all of that sort of assumptions we've made actually manifest themselves through this crisis too. When we look at rent collection in the sector, estimates suggest that around 95% of the rent that was due has actually been collected. And when we compare that to the commercial sector, which is seen around 80% of the rent collected, you see the resilience of the sector that we've spoken about. You know, we've also seen that even though the sector's not been completely immune to the adverse economic effects of the pandemic, we've still seen it kind of rebound quite strongly. So when we look at the lockdown in particular, we saw occupancy levels across our portfolio kind of drop by around 8% in during that period between the end of March to around June, July. But as soon as the lockdown was eased and we saw some of those restrictions lifted and, you know, economic activity started again, people were feeling more comfortable about moving houses and things like that. We saw the lettings activity across our portfolio also rebound very, very strongly. So by the time we got to the end of August, we'd seen our occupancy levels reach above the pre-pandemic levels. So it kind of gives you this sense that, again, there's that needs-based element of the asset class where people always need a place to live. And as soon as, you know, they got into a position where they can move around freely, the market just seemed to go back to what we'd normally see during the summer period. So as a whole, I think we'd say we're very reassured and satisfied that the assumptions that we've made seem to have come true.
Yeah, it's interesting when if we jumped back 9 months, we would have been theorising about what would happen to the sector in moments of extreme crisis. And I would have liked to wait a little longer to have had the data to prove it. But yes, as Mike says, our occupancy fell, but came back really quickly. And our occupancy fell principally because non-UK nationals were instructed by their own governments to return home. And people exercised their break clauses in their lease because we give them flexibility. They exercised those break clauses and went home. But I think the speed of recovery was what has surprised us. The speed to get our occupancy back. So we have more people living in our apartments now than we did in March. And our rent collection, so our own is 97.5% of our rent this year has been collected. And they're much stronger figures than I think we would have expected or anticipated in such an extreme market, that it does show that resilience, that robustness of the cash flow. And ultimately, I think, as Mike said at the beginning, it's a needs-based asset class. People need to live somewhere. And there aren't that many investment opportunities that are based around human need.
Moving on now, I guess we're all anticipating the new normal way of life, where we may return to some sense of normality, but it's obviously highly likely things won't ever be the same again. I mean, what do you think that means for the build-to-rent sector going forwards?
I think we're going to see a rapid growth over the next 2 to 3 years. So I think in 2021, we'll start seeing up and built and income-producing schemes being sold. So we haven't really seen a secondary market in assets yet. So if the people that own these buildings have built them, like ourselves. I think in 2021, we'll start to see some transactions and we'll have much better evidence for the transactional value of these buildings rather than an income on cost, but a valuation that can be relied upon. And I think we'll really see new entrants to the market, the very risk-averse investors who are looking for consistent long-term cash flow, who will look at how the vast majority of the rent has still been collected through moments of distress over the last 9 months. So I think we'll see new investors coming in. I think we'll see much more transaction activity coming in. But I think it's perhaps the way it's influencing the design of the buildings and the way we operate them is also very interesting. So we are thinking much harder about how much space do we provide to allow people to work from home, as an example. Do we design apartments specifically, rather than with a second bedroom, but with a home office? We're already offering our residents office furniture rather than a second bed, if that's what they would prefer to have. But I think the expectation is that the work from home culture, that change that we've experienced over the last few years, to some extent that will continue. And people will be looking at their home environment as somewhere that they will be working as well as living. One of the other questions that gets thrown back to us is the potential that the pandemic is going to force people out of cities. And people are going to want to live in the countryside a bit more and want more space. Now, apart from the fact that we don't have enough countryside to decant everybody from the city centres, I know you've done some research on the reasons for people living in city centres.
Yeah, I think it's one of those really funny things where I personally don't think you want to be making massive life changes during a pandemic. You know, your decision making skills is very much being driven by what's happening at that very moment, which isn't going to exactly be the same in 9 months' time. the idea of people all leaving cities en masse really comes from the idea of, you know, remote working, etc. And fundamentally, that kind of states that the only reason people live in cities is because they work in that city. And I believe that people live in cities because they've got lots of other things going on, you know, whether it's cultural and leisure amenities, nightlife, you know, green spaces, all of these things, which aren't going to change because of the pandemic. So we see that those draws still being there after the pandemic is over and people continue to want to live in those locations. So some of the things that might change might be when we consider places like London, where, you know, you're willing to live slightly further out because you're able to get on the train to get into some of the central locations to kind of make use of those amenities. You might change your decision to live in zone 4, but live in zone 2 because you can walk through all of those draws that we talked about. So those are the more kind of decisions that we see happening, as opposed to people just saying, oh, you know, I don't want to live in London anymore because I can go out to the countryside. That doesn't seem realistic to me.
Talking about how the pandemic has accelerated many trends and changes, I want to move on to talking about ESG, because that's another thing. There's been an increased focus on ESG and sustainability, and it's the big issue on everyone's mind in terms of investments. So in your view, how can the build-to-rent sector and how can build-to-rent properties make meaningful differences in this key area, particularly maybe the E for environment and S for social?
Yeah, I think as a investment impact opportunity, build-to-rent is right up there, because delivering on ESG goals delivers investment performance. They are not mutually exclusive. It is not a decision to spend money on ESG factors and suffer an investment hit. And the principal reason is our ultimate customer, the people who are living in these buildings, creating the cash flows, paying the rent, they value and recognize the ESG agenda. And they value and recognize what we are doing in construction and in the operation of these schemes. So we're in a really privileged position, really, where we can have an absolute focus on ESG, knowing that it is integral in delivering the investment return. A few examples around that. Well, we've made a commitment that all of our portfolio will be net zero carbon in operation by 2030. And 2030 doesn't feel that long away now we've made that commitment, to be honest, but we've made the commitment and we are working towards it. And we've sort of broken down that commitment into three elements. There is the element of in construction and how do we get to net zero carbon in construction. That is really quite difficult, partly because of the embedded carbon in the materials that are being used in construction. There is then how do we act as a landlord? And that's something we're in complete control of. And so that is the way our staff come to work, that is the materials we use to keep the building running, heat it, light it, all that sort of thing. That is something completely in our control and something we can manage, and that's fine. The other area we've just started working on, and in fact this month we've just run a pilot scheme across our portfolio, is what can we do to support our residents in reducing their carbon footprint. So just this month we've run a series of talks, competitions across all of our let portfolios for our let assets for our residents to follow and learn how to reduce their carbon impact and how to have a positive impact through the decisions they make in their daily life. And some of that comes through our design and operation of the building. We can make it easier for them to reduce their carbon impact. What might seem simple, but ensuring all of our energy is sourced from renewables, from maximising retained embedded carbon within developments and minimising the release of any carbon, we can have a big impact. So a huge proportion of the carbon emissions, it comes from the built environment. We know that. But we can build to a quality that far, far exceeds the existing housing stock. So EPC ratings are things most people understand. 93% of our portfolio has an EPC rating of B or better. So we are building very energy efficient buildings anyway, but it's ensuring that our residents, our customers, then have all the tools they need to live low carbon lives within those schemes. I think the social element comes in a number of different ways. I've heard decent arguments which suggest that simply by building homes, you're having a social impact because we have a national shortage. And I think that's true. I do think that simply by investing in the development of housing, that is a help. But we're also working with local businesses and local communities on all of our sites. So our ground floor, we generally have to have commercial space, and that's a planning requirement. And we like to fill that commercial space with local small businesses. And that's creating employment, that's creating expanding the wealth in that area. And it's getting our buildings to be outward looking rather than inward looking. And be part of a wider community rather than be a gated community.
Fantastic. And do you think this is going to be vital to the future of build to rent?
Yeah, I think ultimately the winners and the losers in this sector will be defined by their response to the climate crisis. I think those that are being active and positive about change now, the customer, the resident will recognise that, and they will vote with their feet about where they want to live. And they are in control of the investment return. And if we are not delivering what our customers want, then we will not get the cash flow that it is what our pension funds want. Our investors will go somewhere else. Our investors would move to the build-to-rent operators and developers that are addressing the problem. So I absolutely think that those at the forefront of responding to the climate crisis will be the winners over the next 10 years.
What is your outlook for the future for this sector? You know, we talked a lot about ESG, but what other opportunities and challenges are you anticipating, and how do you think you can navigate them?
If we look at the growth of the sector, so I think a lot of us consider 2012 was the birth of build to rent in the UK, because that was the first really large scheme, which was the old Olympic site. The Olympic Village was converted into a build to rent scheme. So if you think we're 8 years in, and there were some numbers out from Knight Frank a couple of weeks ago, which suggested around £80 billion was already allocated or invested into the UK build to rent sector. And they thought that by 2025, so another 5 years, we will get to 75 billion. 75 billion, that is about 15% of the scale of the commercial real estate sector. But that is a rapid growth from 0 to 15% of institutional real estate investment in the space of what, just over 10 years, 10, 12 years. And so the pension funds that are looking to allocate and looking to track indices and markets, if they're not exposed to the build to rent sector, they're not exposed to a growing proportion of one of their benchmarks. And they need to get exposure to, otherwise they're taking, well, they would be taking increased sector specific risk if they weren't exposed to the sector in a way that the wider market is clearly taking an interest and getting invested into the sector.
One other thing to kind of just consider when we look at it in terms of a long-term outlook for the sector, one of the areas that people talk about when we talk about UK BTR is around the US multifamily market, which is, again, that's the residential rental equivalent to our UK BTR. And it's a far more established sector than ours is. In terms of the capital, that the real estate capital that's allocated to the multifamily sector, it's around a quarter of all of the available capital, institutional capital, goes into residential. For the UK, only about 8% of the capital available goes into the residential sector at the moment. So you can kind of see the sort of the gap where we are compared to another sort of comparable developed economy. So if we make up half of that, you know, that still represents quite a large growth over the next decade or two.
Great. So it sounds like some exciting potential opportunities for the future. So watch this space. Dan and Michael, thank you so much for your time. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.